Hello and welcome to the Android Central podcast. My name is Daniel Bader. This week on the show, Google buys another hardware company and no one knows what the hell they're going to do with it. Chromebooks could finally be gaming machines eventually, somehow. And Qualcomm has a brand new chip for smartwatches, but is Wear OS even ready for this new power? And in the second half of our show, we will revisit the OnePlus Nord with a bunch of new details that leaked slash were trickled out by OnePlus itself this week. And to join me to talk about all of these interesting and fascinating and awesome topics, Jerry Hildenbrand.
Howdy.
Welcome back.
How you doing?
I'm good. It's hot as hell here, but I feel like it's hotter where you are.
Yeah, but it's glorious after, what, 36 months of winter.
Indeed. Well, I mean, we are in the hell mouth right now, so right on top of it. And to talk us through what is and is not on top of the hell mouth, welcome back to the show, Russell Hawley.
Hello.
Are we allowed to acknowledge Buffy right now? I don't know.
I think so. I don't think there was anything wrong with that show.
No, I love Buffy. It's just, I don't know. It made me really sad this week to see all this stuff that Joss Whedon did or reportedly did.
Yes.
I grew up watching Buffy and
same. And Angel and a ton of other stuff.
Yeah.
Horrible.
Firefly was like it's only 15 episodes long, but it's like that show that I watch every year because it's perfect. Anyway, whatever. Not this podcast. But I wanted you on, Russell, because you are, among other things, an expert in AR, gaming, VR, that sort of horizon stack of technologies that we're fast approaching. And you're also the only other person that I know who has been fitted for and wears a pair of Focals, the AR glasses that a Canadian company named North released last year. This company it was a very ambitious project, releasing a pair of custom-made AR glasses. There were reports that they were having trouble raising additional funds, even though they raised about $180 million, that they were looking for a buyer, and that they were really struggling to make up their investments with sales of their first product. So this week we learned that Google has purchased North for about $180 million and that the current generation of Focals are no longer going to work after the end of this month, and that the second generation version that Stephen Lake, the CEO and co-founder, had been teasing for months will not even be released. So I'm sad about this, but you are very sad about this. And I would love to know what your thoughts are on the acquisition and why it upset you so much.
Yeah, so I mean, on the one hand, I am not sad because my biggest takeaway from using Focals was I wish it was more deeply integrated with the Google stuff that I use every day. I have a lot of very strong memories of Google Glass, having been a Google Glass user from day one and used it for well until its expiration time. And the things that kept me using it were things like turn-by-turn navigation and voice controls and being able to have that kind of at-a-glance triage of notifications on my phone. And you could see using Focals that this company was almost there. You know, it was using Amazon to accomplish some of the voice stuff, which was less than ideal in some situations. But the mapping thing for walking directions got better over time. The notification triage was pretty great. And it just, you know, it didn't look weird on your face. Vast majority of the time, you could wear these things and nobody would know that you had a computer strapped to your face. You know, they had accomplished the big thing that made Google Glass unpopular, in that it looked quote unquote normal to have this computer on your face, and it didn't have some of the invasive privacy things that came along. But the thing that bugged me, I think, the most, is that Google has had the ability to make something like Focals for a long time. Glass and Focals are really not that far apart as far as what they're technologically capable of. And that's an impressive thing considering Glass is 8 years old today from when it was first demoed at Google I.O. 8 years ago when Sergey Brin jumped out of an airplane and landed on top of the Moscone West wearing Glass.
Still my favorite conference moment of all time.
It was you know, kind of mind-blowing to remember that was 8 years ago that happened. And the difference between Focals and Glass are just, there's just not a huge rift between these two products from a capability perspective when both of them were kind of in their prime. So I'm frustrated because it feels an awful lot like Google is now ramping up their you know, headset stuff because Apple is doing it. And that's obnoxious because Google was not only here first, but already had a product that was functionally better than what North released in its early form. Now, North is doing some really clever display tech stuff that Google was not doing and you know, hadn't really made any kind of tech, you know, progress announcements in this kind of transparent display tech. And it's something that North shows off. I mean, Daniel, you've been in their store. They have a similar store in Brooklyn, New York, where you walk in and they have these massive displays that show you how their holographic lens stuff works. And it's very cool as long as you have it kind of like perfectly set on your eye to be able to kind of just see through and have this thing look like it's projected in the world. That tech is something that Google is now going to use, but it's just weird to me for Google to have let kind of 8 years pass with almost no progress in the way Glass functioned, and now is kind of ramped up and hiring this other company and going full steam ahead on a thing that, now that we know that Focals version 2 is being scrapped entirely, that probably means from a hardware pipeline perspective, we're not actually going to see functional heads-up display style glasses from Google for like 2 years.
Now, my question is, why would Google just cancel the project as opposed to letting Focals, you know, $180 million is not a ton of money for a company with a market cap near a trillion. And it probably would have been possible to continue with this the way that Google lets Nest, you know, Nest exists as a brand. It's within the Google hardware division, but it does exist on its own. There are its own R&D centers. It's still producing its own products under the Nest brand. Why did Google not let North go ahead with 2.0, knowing that, you know, I guess we've seen so many teases that it would have been such a transformational difference over the first generation?
Well, because they'd have to support them. That's an issue. I mean, Google doesn't want to support the old products of the company it just bought.
There's some of that, but it's also the display tech. North was moving to a different kind of display tech for this version, and it was more of a display sitting on lenses and less of a display that is projected in front of you in order to get that kind of ultra thin feel, because the big thing for Focals 2.0 was that it was going to be way closer to an actual thin set of glasses. It was going to weigh a lot less, and it was going to offer that you know, kind of natural feel. And part of that was a shift in how the display tech worked.
And that is what, something that you don't think Google will eventually use when they do release their own AR product?
Yeah, I think Google's a much bigger fan of having the display kind of projected in front of you where you have a field of view that the information shows up in, as opposed to a display that you can see through, where the text is kind of you know, right there at eye level. There's a functional difference in how those things work. And, you know, if Google's plan is to merge some of the lessons that it learned from Glass to the stuff that is being done with Focals, then it would make sense for Google to want to encourage the stuff happening with its legacy, with Focals' legacy tech, instead of moving to this newer stuff. But the support thing that Jerry mentioned is also a super good point. The software that goes into Focals is, and Daniel, you've used this, it's almost kind of slapped together. You know, every couple of weeks when Focals really came out, they were like, hey, we added this new feature. And it was like, by the time it was at its high point, there were like six different to-do apps for you know, checking things off when you had finished things, a couple of different ways to have email served to you. But not, they weren't doing a whole lot of new features. It was so much allowing other companies to, you know, pop their API into an existing product. And so you had this kind of complicated array of things that didn't have a ton of things in common with one another, and it wasn't presented in like an app store form per se. And when you combine that with the original mission of Wear OS, when it got changed from WatchOS, like when the name of it got changed way back when it first got rebranded, the whole deal there was it was going to cover a spectrum of wearables. Like their big announcement at Google I/O that year was, you know, this is the name of the operating system we're going to use for glasses and for watches and for, you know, for all this stuff. So it wouldn't shock me that they are not interested in supporting that and would instead prefer everything be under the same branding as what's happening on their watches right now, which would be more impressive if the things happening on their watches were good. But that's another matter entirely.
Yeah, we'll get
you know,
to that.
That kind of, you said before, it's frustrating that Google didn't do a Glass 2. You know, I've been a Glass user from day one too, and I was, you know, really into the tech at first, and then I kind of, you know, fell out of love with it, I guess to say. I think that Google has played the long game with not only Glass, but a lot of their products. And when they can build their own processor, things are going to explode. I mean, you know from using Glass that the biggest takeaway is don't use your hands. Google Assistant needed to be better and actually work and do everything sure. You needed to do on Glass.
And we're definitely there now, whereas we were not there 8 years ago. So,
but we, you know, we can't use a crappy 2-core Motorola 800 megahertz CPU to do all that. So I think that, you know, the rumors that say Google is going to design their own CPUs are absolutely true, and they may or may not design a CPU for Pixel phones and or laptops, but they're going to definitely work on their wearables and Internet of Things stuff with their own custom chip.
Let's take a bit of a step back and look at the high level market for, you know, potential market for AR glasses. So we have Google Glass released in 2012, 2013, very exclusive. It was not ever widely available for consumers. It has ended up being very much an enterprise and industry focused product in its current iteration. There is still, you know, a single lens on the right side, and it's gesture based. I believe there's still a camera on this version, mm-hmm. but it's still very much the same product that Google shipped 8 years ago. Focals 2.0, Focals had no camera. It had the bulk of its tech in the frames on the side that required a pretty large charging case to carry with you. It was pretty expensive when it was first announced, $1,000. The price dropped to $700, and everybody who bought the first version got a refund a few months later. You needed a ring, basically a joystick, to manipulate the operating system. It was an Android-based operating system, and it was a little clunky, Russell. I'll say that it never really felt natural to me having to put this joystick on my thumb or you know, whatever, one of my fingers to use it. And I believe that Focals 2.0, in addition to being lighter and thinner, would have added a camera, and it would have somehow altered this input mechanism. So we have that on the Android / non-Apple side. And then earlier this year, John Prosser, who hasn't always been accurate in his predictions, but he said he was pretty accurate, pretty confident about this one, released a bunch of information about this forthcoming Apple Glass product that would use LiDAR to basically detect your hands in front of you for manipulating the UI. Plus, there would be gestures on the side of the glass. It would be plastic. It would be $500 plus the price of a prescription. So we have a bunch of companies approaching AR glasses very differently. Snap is another company with its own kind of very camera focused and very mainstream focused glasses.
Yeah. And Nreal.
Nreal, which you've reviewed that's a completely different approach. So in your ideal world, what would a Google Glass 2.0 look like when it comes out in two or 3 years?
Yeah. So I think ideally it would be the kind of, you know, computer that looks like glasses and doesn't kind of stick out. I'm not as excited about having a camera on it as I used to be. The whole concept of glass being able to kind of take a picture with a wink and stuff like that was cool. But camera tech evolves at such a pace now, that it just seems, you know, I'm never not going to want to reach for my phone for something. And some of that is me being kind of the spoiled tech guy who has the latest camera at all times and so can take really nice pictures. But because of that, I'm unlikely to use the camera strapped to my face more often than I would the really nice camera in my pocket. So the camera is not as exciting to me. The gesture controls, on the other hand, I think are really useful. I think, you know, being able to kind of quickly brush something off on the side of your head, or being able to kind of nod your head in order to make notifications going away, was really useful on Glass, and I'd like to see that come back. Because you're right, the Ring was kind of messy. Although there was some interesting conversation about, instead of using the joystick, using one of the swipe over pads like used to be on the HTC Desire series, like way back in the day. Mm-hmm. Having that instead of the joystick. I'm not sure I would hate that idea. I'd be interested to try that out. But that is, you know, that kind of optical sensor for swiping instead of the physical joystick might have made that situation a little more enjoyable. I think ultimately it comes down to voice commands, you know, having the voice commands be seamless. And we've reached a point now where, you know, I see an increasing number of people, it seems like every day, using speech to text on their phone, you know, like people walking down the street, sending messages, you know, by talking into their phone and, you know, sitting in restaurants doing the same thing. I think that tech has gotten way good enough that having it, you know, kind of seamlessly work on your face, where it's that kind of ambient computing experience, I think would be a really powerful thing to have work. And I also think that the price point that we're seeing with Nreal and what was promised for the second generation of Focals, that $500 range is probably where we're going to hover at for a while. I think Apple's going to try and come in relatively close to that, based on the stuff that we've heard from Prosser. And I think that's probably what we're going to end up looking like in within the next 2 or 3 years is right around $200 for this computer that is not terribly different from, you know, kind of the watch experience as far as the content it delivers you. But does it in this kind of ambient computing way that makes it just feel like a part of your environment instead of another gadget you have to worry about.
You know what I think? You know, this is just my crazy idea. Think of it as a second screen for your phone.
Sure, yeah.
That's really all a Google Glass 2 would need to be.
Well, that was the original promise of the watch, right? Was to be that kind of second, the big thing. When Sergey Brin was first talking about glass and first talking about watches, was how did he put it? It was a really gross term that I disagreed with at the time, but I understood what he meant. Emasculated. He said that he felt emasculated, constantly swiping around on his glass screen. And that was why he preferred having something like Google Glass or the watch. And that sentiment was weird, but the concept behind it, I understood. Having that kind of second screen, I think you're right.
But yeah, your phone would know when you had glass connected, and you tell assistant you want to watch a YouTube video about, you know, whatever, the next OnePlus phone, and just have it projected with Focal's original way of, you know, I agree, that's probably what Google is more interested in, is having things appear as a projection in front of you. And people would love that if the price was right, to have literally anything on their phone appear in front of their face.
Yeah, I wonder if these companies are waiting until processing is efficient enough and powerful enough that you can project AR, you know, the pieces of AR, whether they're objects or data overlays, in front of you seamlessly, the way that HoloLens does it, but with a wider field of view without the physical object over your head, you know, mixed reality. And we'll talk about this in a minute with Qualcomm, but like XR is this term that is nebulous at best, but this is something that HoloLens and Qualcomm and many of its partners are trying to accomplish, right? This very delicate balance between AR and VR. And I wonder if for the mainstream, like, I think the most interesting AR use case right now is going to Google, typing in like goat or whatever, and being able to like put an augmented reality goat on your desk, because it's super approachable. It's really, really fun. Kids love it. And it's a way for people to see that AR works.
Another really good example of this, it is augmented reality, but it is done through the lens of virtual reality, is a more recent update to the Oculus Quest. When you put the Quest on and you have a boundary set up so that you don't, you know, punch a wall or something, the first thing it does now is it gives you a black and white view of your room. And if you have stuff on the floor in your boundary, it puts these purple lines above that thing. So like I had a pair of shoes in my workout room this morning, and I put my headset on, and it actually brought up a whole bunch of purple lines around the shoes to be like, hey, you need to move those before you start playing a game or you're going to trip over them later.
That's
like
so
a Diablo
cool.
3 boss drop.
Exactly. Yeah. And I just thought like it was the first time that it had caught me, and it's and it was just amazing. Like as a mechanism for augmented reality for my headset to remember what my room looks like and know that that thing is out of place. Is something that I could definitely appreciate in kind of a future thing, especially if it's something like if you get to a point where it can map multiple rooms and you can say something like, where did I put my keys down? Like to be able to have that kind of like tile tracker, you know, thing, but done in augmented reality where it just pops up a light and goes, this is where that thing is. And you just follow the light until you find it. Like that I think is a genuinely powerful usage of this tech.
Google would rather you buy a separate tracker and put it on your keychain,
yes,
so it can keep track of where your keys are.
That is also true.
So, Russell, we sort of talk about this in the frame of Android, everything we talk about. Last week, we had Harish and Joe on to talk about iOS 14. Obviously, ARKit is a big deal. It may not have been a big deal this year as much as it was in previous years, but... Apple is making a very, very big push into AR. Is there anything right now that you see as a really great example of AR on the smartphone, on either side of the fence, Apple or Google?
Yeah, I think my favorite version of augmented reality, you know, when it comes to a, you know, kind of a very visual thing that you can show people, comes in the form of games right now. You know, there are a lot of these kind of really fun activities where you start up a game, and instead of putting, you know, a character on a table in front of you, it actually gives you a whole virtual door for you to walk through. And when you take your phone and you step through that portal, everything changes. You know, so it's still the room that you're in, like it's still all of the same basic geometric shapes that are around you. But now, you know, like it looks like the Upside Down from Stranger Things. You walk through and everything is just twisted and warped. And you know, so from a playability perspective, that is the kind of thing that they're putting in museums and they're putting in you know, college campuses and stuff, so that you can install an application and just kind of amp up the experience of wherever you are. Cause that's the, you know, your phone, you're still going to be looking through glass, you know, you're still going to be looking through this, you know, plastic, and glass thing in front of you. So, you know, making it so that you are adding content to the world around you instead of completely replacing it is a really beneficial thing that we're seeing doing. So like you go into a museum and, there's a massive statue of George Washington and he actually steps down and starts talking to you. You know, instead of completely replacing the environment around you. And that I think is my favorite thing about AR on a phone right now. And it's something that does happen, a lot better. It's smoother right now on iOS than it is on Android.
Yeah. There's no question that Apple cares a lot more about ARKit than Google does AR Core. And we didn't get Google I/O this year to prove us otherwise. So maybe we'll have to wait until next year. Alas.
Yeah, I mean, the one thing that AR Core still does better than AR Kit is shared experiences. That is something that Google championed early, and it's something that Apple didn't add until later, and then not as many developers have picked up on it. But the ability to build something in augmented reality and then kind of pin it to that world so that when somebody else walks into that room and fires up the same application, they can see a note left behind by someone or be able to play a game together and have it actually be that kind of collaborative thing. You know, AR on an iPhone is very much a solo experience. Whereas, you know, starting early on, you know, Google had the foresight to make it a collaborative thing. And I hope that as Google pushes into this a little more, that it continues down that path. Because that was the most fun thing that I did at I.O. last year was a group of six people tracing, like drawing designs in a sandbox together, and then being able to kind of step back and look at all of that collaborative stuff.
Yeah, that's a really memorable thing that comes from these new technologies rolling out. And you know, you are somebody who you're an evangelist for these new experiences, right? You, Anshul, I keep hearing about people who live in this world that will be like, okay, you need to buy an Oculus Quest, not just because you need another gadget in your house, but because Supernatural is this amazing experience, and I have a competition going with all these guys, and I'm going to beat them at, you know, whatever. And it's that kind of thing that draws people in, as opposed to AR is great and just wait until Apple will prove it to you during its next keynote, which never really happens.
Yeah, I mean, from a keynote perspective, the last couple of things that Apple have done have been very much a look how cool this demo is, and then it never really goes beyond that, and that's been really unfortunate.
So I want to, we're talking a little bit about gaming. I want to shift over to a conversation about gaming on Chromebooks. So this is not a narrative that is discussed very much. In fact, the only real gaming that you get on Chromebooks right now is kind of through Stadia. But there's this new thing that we've been hearing about for months and months, and Kyle Bradshaw at 9to5 Google was doing some digging and came up with it's basically a new version of Linux that would live inside Chrome OS based on Ubuntu rather than Debian, and it will allow Steam games to run natively, or at least not natively, but through an emulation you know, view on Chromebooks. And as somebody who does not quite understand the scope of Linux, both of you do better than me, Jerry, walk us through this and why this is a big deal, and whether this will mean in a year from now, AAA games will be released, at least available on Chrome, the way that they are in Windows PCs today.
First, we need to temper our expectations a little bit there. There may be a few AAA games that are available that you could install and run on a Chromebook, but you're not going to be very happy with even the GPU in a 10th generation Intel processor. It's just, you look at a gaming PC and everybody says, yeah, I got this, this, and this, and then I've got this graphics card that cost me $1,900 or...
You're still going to want Stadia in order to play The Last of Us Part 2. Like, you're not going to...
And that's I think Google knows that. That's why it's not opposed to making Steam more available. You can install Steam on almost any Chromebook right now. All you have to do is go grab the Steam package for Debian and just click it, and it installs, and it works just fine until you start to play the games. The games are very sluggish and choppy. It's worse than they are on a comparably spec'd Windows laptop. That's because Chrome doesn't, you know, it's, I hate to use the word emulated. Linux applications are native in the sense that they're inside their own container, sandboxed from the rest of the world, but there's still a little bit of extra overhead from the main operating system. So they aren't exactly native. They aren't exactly emulated. That's just how container technology works. Inside that container, there's just not a lot of support to play the games. Right. For Google to officially make Steam available, you just go click a link at steamstore.com with your Chromebook, and it installs it right into Chrome without you having to enable Linux support or command line support or anything.
So, I mean, you have to think about the original reason that Linux, Steam on Linux was such a popular idea, I guess, 10, 15 years ago, was that, you know, through a Linux kernel, you could have greater access to kind of the bare metal of the you know, the board that you're working with. So you could get more out of that processor. And that is still technically true when you install Linux through Chrome, but Chrome is still the layer in between Linux and
Absolutely.
And the rest of the operating system. So the only way that this becomes useful is the way that I understand it. The only way this becomes useful is if Chrome itself starts to enable things like native hardware acceleration In order to make that work. Now, I don't know that I've seen anything about Chrome making that official anytime soon, but like that would not only make gaming more interesting, it would also make some of the things that that Chromebooks have struggled to do for a little while with like Photoshop, you know, through Chrome, you know, something that got announced a while ago and still hasn't ever really turned out.
Even better support for the web.
Yeah. You know, being able to enable that kind of native hardware acceleration would solve for this in a way, because it would give the Linux kernel greater access to the hardware. But it would also make Chrome more functional in those situations. So like that would, as exciting as the concept of Steam is on Chrome, in order for that to be useful, it would be native hardware acceleration on Chrome, which for me is even more exciting.
So I want to make sure that we understand the distinction, because right now there is hardware acceleration inside a Chrome browser on a Chromebook, right? There is
Correct.
Some form of it.
Yeah.
But we're
talking
CPU
specifically about GPU.
Yeah.
Just taking processes from the GPU and essentially moving them off the CPU so that you just have more firepower to work with, and you know, give and be able to divvy up tasks between the two more easily or more specifically.
The game was written for the GPU to do certain things without the CPU needing to intervene. And on a Chromebook right now, that doesn't happen. The CPU still has to translate the instructions so the GPU can process them. Native support means the GPU instruction set, you know, it just matches the game and it just works without any CPU support or interference. And that's what we need.
In an ideal world, something changes, Chrome OS gets an update, native GPU acceleration is supported, Google rolls out an update and brings native Steam support. You can then download and play games on Chromebooks that run 10th generation Intel chips. What is that experience like compared to, say, a Dell XPS 13 that is similarly spec'd?
It's going to depend on the game.
Right.
There are a lot of games that support other graphical rendering processes that aren't DirectX. Microsoft has a pretty good lock-in with game developers with DirectX because it works. It's fairly easy to work with from a developer point of view, and for a user, it just works. You just install the game and it just works. It automatically detects your settings and go. Linux games, they can't use DirectX. They have to have, you know, usually it's OpenGL support. Russell, have we moved a little bit further into, you know, I can't even think of the name of the GPU support that you know what I'm talking about. Please help me.
Yeah, I know what you're talking about. And the quick answer is a lot of the newer, smaller games or games that have been refreshed not terribly long ago. For example, Command & Conquer Remastered that just came out. You know, mm-hmm. the original Command & Conquer libraries didn't require DirectX. It functioned in OpenGL and some of the other libraries. And the remaster followed that path. So, like, Command & Conquer, in theory, Command & Conquer Remastered would run better on a Chromebook than it would a similarly expect Dell XPS. Like, it would be a noticeable...
Vulkan is what I was thinking of.
Yeah, so with native Vulkan support, it would run, you would see a noticeable difference. I think in a lot of tests, it ends up being somewhere between 15 and 20 frames per second difference.
Yes, but the easy answer to your question, Daniel, is the Dell XPS with very similar hardware is probably going to do better until game studios make that change.
Right. And I mean, it comes down to, you know, from my perspective, what I'm curious about is why is Google investing in this effort at all, knowing that Stadia is just this separate object that lives inside a Chrome browser. You don't need to worry about local hardware specs. And by the end of this year, a lot of these AAA titles that wouldn't play on, you know, natively on a Chromebook will just play on any Chromebook. It doesn't matter how old or how modestly spec'd. And I wonder why Google cares about this.
Well, because Chromebooks need native 3D GPU support, period. Russell talked about it. You need it for the web. You need it for AR. Just about everything you can do on a Chromebook that uses your graphics processing power would be better with native support for, you know, for 3D acceleration.
But that does not, but that's separate to the fact that Google looks like it may be changing the Linux distro from Debian to Ubuntu so that it can support, better support Steam.
Yeah, see, that I know we're still talking rumors. I don't buy that at all.
Well,
I
don't think that's actually what's happening.
Maybe.
I run Steam on Debian all day long, no problems. It's zero difference from Ubuntu, and Ubuntu is basically Debian with just a few front-end changes.
Yeah.
I don't know that there are going to be any big changes to the version of Linux, quote-unquote, that Google's using. I think what they're going to do is have this ability where you don't have to enable support for Linux applications for certain things, like Steam. It's going to be its own container that doesn't need user intervention. Right now, to install Steam on a Chromebook, you have to go into the settings, you have to enable Linux support, then you have to go into the command line and you have to enable the way the package manager can find packages at a different location, and then you install Steam. And it will find the dependencies it needs and automatically load them, and it just works. Steam works great. The games work horribly. If Google would change that to where you just click a button and install Steam, that's great for users, but I don't think that's the end goal here. I think that's just an after effect that, you know, oh, you know, if we do this, you could just install Steam with one click. Oh, go, let's go ahead and add that.
Well, no, I think the answer to the question why Steam is perhaps a little simpler than that, Jerry. I think Google recognizes that it's in the middle of a really fascinating kind of cultural thing right now where a ton of kids have gone through all of middle school and high school on Chromebooks, and when they leave high school, they want to buy something they're familiar with. This is actually something Dell talks about this a lot in why they're starting to build more mature Chromebooks with its XPS Chromebook line. Like why it's starting to market these is Dell is seeing these kids who are leaving high school and go, okay, so like I want my own computer when I go to college. What computer do I want? Chrome OS is what I've used all going through school. But my friends are all on this thing because of gaming.
That's a good point. I never thought of. I'll admit it.
And so
I didn't even.
Yeah, I think having Steam, you know, gives them access to, at the very least, a smaller library of games that are never coming to Stadia. You know, you think about kind of right. the Steam, you know, early sales or summer sales that come out where it's, you know, it's 90 games for a nickel. You know, those games are never coming to Stadia. You know, it doesn't matter how popular Stadia gets. And so giving kids access to those games makes it a more viable platform for when they leave high school and consider a machine of their own.
And Steam has a social aspect.
That's true, yeah.
So
as a Mac user, that happens to me all the time. Like I buy Humble Bundles a lot. I end up not being able to play 98% of the games
right.
because they're Windows only.
Yeah, so
and there are all these great indie games that I would love to play anyway. So yeah, that's a great point, Russell. It also speaks to the success of Chromebooks in general, because holy cow, like millions and millions of kids are going to be Chromebook native, and this is the first generation that's ever been the case.
Yeah, and if you talk to anytime you talk to Dell marketing people when they talk about why they are, you know, kind of making their Chromebooks more mature, that this is the answer they give, is they see this market of kids emerging, and they're trying to head them off at the pass and make sure that Dells are still what they're buying.
Right.
That's why they're smart. Dude,
yeah, I mean, that's Dell is, I mean, a few years ago, you never would have been able to say this, but Dell has been smart for many years in a row now.
Yeah.
So, and that happened when they went private. So good on them. Seriously, they've been killing it lately.
Now I'm more optimistic. Thanks, Russell.
Oh, good. So we can end the segment.
Well, now there's money in it. As soon as you add money into something, it's much bigger chance it'll happen.
That's true. Yeah. Speaking of money, we have to take a quick break and thank a sponsor. So we will be right back. This episode of the Android Central podcast is brought to you by Aslo. In 2020, every business in the country is learning how to adapt day to day to what's going on. But why aren't banks? unnecessary fees or taking a trip to your bank is the last thing business owners need to be thinking about. And Aslo takes all the friction out of business banking instead of insisting you handle your banking as if the internet never existed. I have used the same bank forever, and my banking, my business banking in particular, was a super hassle. I had to go to the branch all the time. I had to talk to tellers. I don't want to talk to tellers. I want to deal with everything over the internet the way it should be. I want a mobile app that works. Aslo is a free business checking account with invoicing, bill pay, money transfers, no minimum balance, and no fees. And unlike banking options, there is no minimum deposit required. You'll never be charged maintenance or overdraft fees, and there's no ridiculous phone system that feels designed to waste your time. Instead of days or weeks it takes to apply for an account at a traditional bank where you're still required to go in person, with Aslo, you go to azlo.com and apply in as little as 10 minutes. There's no waiting to use your account either. With Aslo's free instant funding feature, you can deposit up to $1,000 and access it immediately with no holds. Aslo is owned by BBVA USA, member FDIC. And when they make business banking easy and offer a free checking account, Money Magazine called them the best business banking option for freelancers and entrepreneurs. And that's why I definitely recommend Aslo for all of your business banking needs. They have an amazing system from the web to their app and everything in between. And right now, you can sign up for Aslo and get a free copy of Aslo's Small Business Starter Guide by going to aslo.com/ACP. That's AZLO.com/ACP to sign up for a free Small Business Starter Guide and no minimum deposit. That's AZLO.com/ACP. And thanks, Aslo, for sponsoring the Android Central podcast. Okay, and we are back. So in this next segment, I want to talk about smartwatches. And this is an interesting week because Qualcomm has been quiet on the Snapdragon Wear front for a while. And when they announced the Snapdragon Wear 3100, it was over a year ago now, that was really not as impressive as we hoped it would be. So this is the Snapdragon Wear 4100, and it is a new architecture. It reduces the manufacturing node in size from 28 to 12 nanometers. It moves the cores from an ancient A7 design to a much more modern A53. It improves the GPU performance immensely. It improves the clock speeds of both GPU and CPU by like 80%. It's got an improved coprocessor on the Snapdragon Wear 4100 Plus. It supports native eSIM if you want LTE connectivity. This is the chip that we were hoping the 3100 would be. So that's on one side. This is going to be powering Wear OS devices throughout, you know, the rest of 2020 and 2021. And then we have an imminent release of the Galaxy Watch 3 by Samsung. This has been leaked all to hell. Max Weinbach has been just killing it on that side, getting tons and tons of really interesting leaks on it. It's a very iterative update to the Galaxy Watch, but it's still the most popular Android smartwatch, if you can call it that. So let's dive into the Snapdragon Wear, Jerry, and talk about why it's impressive and whether this will actually be the impetus for Google to get off its ass and do something with the Wear OS software.
I have to be honest. I don't think it's that impressive.
Okay, so you don't actually.
I do like what Qualcomm has done beefing up the coprocessor, because that's really important when your main CPU is at least 2 years behind in technology than what Samsung and Apple are doing. And I hate to knock something before I've tried it, but you used the word new architecture. No, this architecture is 5 years old. It's much better than the 3100. I don't even need to see it in action to know that that's true. But the 3100 was so bad that just about anything should be better than that. I don't like that the only thing it's compared to, and of course this is how it's going to be, is Qualcomm is telling us how much better it is than the old one we hated. Well, it better, you know, it has to be better than that one. Tell me about how it matches up to the S5 and the Apple Watch, you know, because that's, I'm not a big wearable guy, but I have used a Galaxy Watch 2, an Apple Watch, I think version 4, and, you know, Android Wear on the 3100 platform, and Android Wear was just terrible. And part of it is Google's fault because the operating system is still a bit of a mess. But my biggest issue was it took forever for apps to load up. It took forever for everything to happen because it was CPU bound 90% of the time. That's why you had to charge it every 8 hours. It was just a mess.
Right.
I don't want you to just be better than that. I want you to be as good as the competition.
That is a very apt point, especially if you know the history of the Snapdragon Wear family. The Snapdragon Wear, the early smartwatches in that ran Wear OS were basically just running off-the-shelf Snapdragon 400 chips.
Yep.
They rebranded it to Snapdragon Wear 2100, which was still a Snapdragon 400 in another name. The Snapdragon 400 was announced in 2012. So it is an eight-year-old chip, and that architecture did not change in the 3100. So it's been that way for 8 years. So this is the only real upgrade that Wear OS watches have ever received in their entire lifetime. And they've been around for 6 years now. So that's a really good point that you bring up.
What frustrates me the most is I look at the Snapdragon, the 835. Isn't that the first one that came out after the 821? Somebody will correct me if I'm wrong, I'm sure. But you look at how Qualcomm was able to take one generation between, you know, the Nexus, the last Nexus, and the next Galaxy S. You look at how far Qualcomm was able to come when they knew they had to. They put a great GPU and a great CPU together on a chip with their legendary, you know, wireless technology. Qualcomm just has that in the bag. That's why they can charge so much for it, because it's so good. And our phones instantly became wow. You know, they just put a wow factor in it. And yes, I have said it, and lots of people say it, well, you know, Apple's chips are so much faster. Doesn't matter. Qualcomm's latest flagship processor will do more than your phone can ever ask it to do. It's more than powerful enough to do anything. Qualcomm was able to do that because they realized they needed to. I just don't think they put that same gusto into this update for wearables.
Did they need to, though? That's the thing, right? Like, if they're not really, their only client right now for Snapdragon Wear products, their clients, I guess, are OEMs that buy them to build Wear OS devices. So Google is not their client. It's
right.
Fossil brand, and it's Mobvoi, which makes all the TicWatch smartwatches. That's basically it.
But don't you want Wear OS to get better?
I do.
Yeah.
But I'm thinking about it, like, you've talked many times about Qualcomm's business strategy, right? And the fact that this is a company that sells chips and then licenses its patents. That is their core competency. So from a business decision perspective, was a significant in terms of upgrades over the previous version, but still, you know, kind of ham-fisted update. The right move from a business perspective. And I don't know if that's true or not. I mean, maybe it is.
I think it probably is true, but you're talking, you know, making sense and being logical. I want to talk a world where Wear OS can be as good as, you know, what you find on Watch OS? Apple Watch OS?
Yeah, Watch
whatever
OS.
It is.
Yeah, Watch OS.
For Wear OS to be as good as Watch OS, it needs a better processor, period. Google can't even try to make it do much more because there's no power to make it do that. And I love that Qualcomm has beefed up the coprocessor, take a lot of load off the main CPU. That's pretty much what Apple does. There are a lot of other ways they could do that. Maybe the older architecture they're using in the CPU would be enough if there was a companion coprocessor that would do all the background functions. There are a lot of ways they could have done it, and they didn't, and you're probably right, because this is a better business decision. This will be better. OEMs will still order it. Qualcomm will still make money.
So, Russell, I guess let's look at it from the consumer's point of view. So when watches roll out later this year, it'll be the, you know, the Fossil Gen 6 or the Skagen Falster 4, whatever they're called, the TicWatch Pro 2021, they will run this chip. What would you like it to enable on a software side that Google could then take that extra headroom and just completely blow our minds with Wear OS?
And don't say AR.
No, definitely not AR. No, my favorite thing about Wear OS has always been the gesture controls. I thought that was super clever the first time Google rolled it out, and then when they tweaked it a little bit, and unfortunately the processors have never been great enough for it to be super reliable. When you get a notification and you can just kind of shake your wrist and make the notification go away, or you can shake it back in order to bring back an application that you had available. I think about the Apple Watch constantly and how much better it would be with these gesture controls. When you think about stuff like August, they're smart locks. There's an August app for my watch that I can go through and tap to open. But the steps that it takes in order to get to that application on my watch, it is fewer steps to open my phone and do that, because Apple's app ecosystem is vast, but switching between apps is really just inconvenient on the watch. And that's something that Google has the ability to do way better with Gesture Nav. You know, if you have a set of, you know, six apps that you regularly use on your watch for stuff, you know, being able to flip between them by just wiggling your wrist in a certain pattern, I think could be a really powerful thing that Google could very easily go, this is something, you know, this is something no one else is doing, and it's something that actually increases your quality of life by having this thing on your wrist.
Yeah, I see your, that would be awesome to have a few apps pinned,
right,
with easy access. That would be great.
I mean, gestures, notifications, there are things that Wear OS does well. I think there's an understanding that Apple's advantage, you know, there's obviously a silicon advantage, there's an app ecosystem advantage, there's just like a social fitness advantage, right? Everybody who has an Apple Watch is able to compete with one another to share their rings. Google has bought Fitbit bought Pebble. Google now owns Pebble, which will own Pebble, I guess, which makes me super happy. This is a company that, you know, we don't know a lot about the internals of Fitbit products. That's actually something the company's kept really, really close to the chest over the years. Obviously, even the most advanced Fitbit products, like the Versa 2, are still not quite as smooth as an Apple Watch, and they're sort of hybrids. They're more fitness trackers than smartwatches. But here's what I'm looking at, right? We're looking at Google now owning a hardware company that makes smartwatches. Google owns a very, very robust social ecosystem with Fitbit's millions of users, plus a ton of sleep data. And this is a company that loves to suck up data, and that's why it's being scrutinized in the EU, by the way. So we have that side of it. Then we have Wear OS, which has been in stasis for like 3 years now. Now we have the question of, Wear OS relies on Qualcomm SoCs, which have been pretty bad. And we go back to the question of, does Google start competing with Qualcomm to build its own wearables SoCs as a precursor to silicon for smartphones down the road? And I know that's a huge leap, but it does feel like all the things are in place right now, yep, for that to happen.
I think so. I think if Google would release a Pixel watch using a processor that very well-paid engineers have spent a year or more to develop exactly for Wear OS, and it does everything that Wear OS does well, and then they add things like Russell's idea of pinning frequently used apps, And when people see it and they see how well it works, that forces Qualcomm to build a processor that's equally optimized for Wear OS through, you know, separate co-processing architecture. And then Wear OS can flourish more. I don't really think that Google's goal is to make, you know, wearables, whether they be glasses or watches, to try to actually make lots of money. I think their idea is much like it was with Android things. Let's build something that with the right hardware behind it is really easy to use, and it's so good that everybody will love it.
Well, we know that Google is doing some of these things, and I hope that, you know, before long there are some there's some fruits of that labor to show for it. In the meantime, we have a brand new Snapdragon Wear chip, two of them actually, the 4100 and 4100 Plus, that are going to be available later this year. 85% faster, 25% longer battery life, lots of, you know, hyperbolic claims that it will enable better productivity, blah, blah, blah. I don't care.
I need to
about
take
that.
A minute and set the stage for the 3100 announcement, because Nirav and I were there, and I got to tell you, Qualcomm flew people into New York from all over the country. They paid for these people to come in, influencers who sat and listened to this presentation on how great the 3100 was going to be because of this amazing new motion coprocessor. They had little plastic versions of the motion coprocessor that sat on the tip of your finger that they handed out to people. And then they had them in these little plastic casings that people could take home. The video that Fisher did for the launch had, you know, this little chip in a piece of glass that you could kind of go through and see. They hyped this thing up so much that when a bunch of people left, including our friend Jaime Rivera, was mistaken in thinking that was the new processor. Like Qualcomm did such a good job obfuscating that it was still the 2100 chipset. They focused the entire presentation on this motion coprocessor and handed it out to everyone so that when everyone talked about it, they were just like, this new processor is so small. And Nirav and I had to stop them in the middle of the Pocket Now podcast and be like, guys, that's just the motion coprocessor. The actual processor is still exactly the same. Because Qualcomm worked so hard during that presentation to hide that from people. And so it is genuinely hard for me to get excited about this, even though there are some genuine technical benefits here. Like the amount of obfuscation that Qualcomm has done with its Wear chips in the past is really, it makes me want to not be excited until I have one of these watches on my wrist.
Right. And I want to say, I really hope that my low expectations are proven wrong.
Oh, same. Yeah.
I hope when, you know, the first 4100 plus wearable with running Wear OS comes out, that it's just freaking super.
Oh, totally.
And Google sees it and says, oh, we can implement more ideas. This runs so well. I really want that to be the case. I just don't think it will be.
Because here's the thing. While the processor hasn't really changed in a couple of years, Android Wear watches are pretty.
Yeah.
Like they're just so nice looking. You know, and you know, it was kind of fascinating. There was this concern with all of the luxury brands, you know, kind of converging on Wear OS, that things were going to get kind of clunky and messy. But I tell you, like, there are, like, at CES this year, you know, seeing the room full of Android Wear watches that were coming out, it was so sad that all of these watches were running 3100 because they were all gorgeous.
Yep. Well, even not just the luxury brands, even, you know, consumer fashion brands. Look at Fossil's Android Wear watches.
Absolutely.
They are beautiful. I would wear one in a heartbeat if it wasn't such a dog when I turn the screen on.
Yeah, same.
So I will say, adding a gigabyte to these Wear OS watches has done wonders for its performance. It seemed like, you know, going from 512 to 768 megs was going to make a difference. It didn't. You know, the Tick Watch Pro did that a couple of years ago. It really didn't help. But all of these latest Gen 5 based Wear OS watches, so we have the Fossil Gen 5, we have the ones from Michael Kors, from Skagen, from Diesel, Puma, a lot of those Fossil brands, basically every luxury lifestyle brand you know, or not luxury lifestyle brand you know, is owned by Fossil. It did a lot of good for the performance, but Wear OS is still kind of useless in when it comes to anything but notification triage. So I just want to shift the conversation to another watch that may actually be announced next week. It's the Galaxy Watch 3. And we've seen a bit of, you know, a trickle of news, and then all of a sudden everything came out at once. It's a much nicer, thinner design. It's still got that rotating bezel. It has they're called information edges, but basically they're just complications, mm-hmm. which let you pin your heart rate or your battery or the weather to any watch face that you have. There seem to be a bunch of nice new watch faces. Samsung's finally building nice new watch faces onto its smartwatches. There's weather backgrounds where the weather will adapt to the time of day. So it'll show you a dark background at night and a nice sunrise in the morning, things like that. A revamped Galaxy store and an overhauled music player. So there's lots to look forward to here. I wonder though, Russell, is this something that you're interested in just from a non-Samsung user? Or is this, you know, does a Galaxy Watch have interest beyond just the Samsung hardcore?
Yeah, I think, you know, Samsung is providing a visual alternative that still keeps a lot of the fitness stuff. You know, so when I see people in stores looking at these things, you know, the big thing, like you said earlier, the big thing about the Apple Watch is the kind of social aspect to all of the fitness stuff, but also just the sheer volume of the fitness things you can do. And when you see a demo of a Samsung watch in a Best Buy, for example, the kind of scrolling animation stuff, that's all it focuses on. You know, you can, it'll let you know that you haven't had a drink of water in a while, or that you need to go for a run, you know, or you know, that it'll automatically, you know, track stuff when you go and do it. And we know as kind of techie nerds that stuff is a little on the clumsy side, but it's a thing that genuinely gets people excited. So focusing on being able to glance down and see your heart rate or glance down and see your steps and still have a more dynamic watch. And this is still something that's important to a lot of people. The fact that it's round, is something that still attracts a lot of people, you know? So I think that is, I think Samsung is still in a relative position of power there, to attract people who are not swayed to the Apple Watch.
One thing that reinforces Russell's point is if you go to Amazon today, you'll notice that even though the Galaxy Watch is coming up on 2 years old, it is the fourth most popular smartwatch under the men's smartwatches category. It is the 44th most popular overall. It has not lost its value. It still costs $260 for the 42-millimeter version. And it seems like, at least anecdotally from our content that we've posted on the Galaxy Watch, much more popular than the Galaxy Watch Active series. Mm. Because it just, I guess it has that timeless appeal, and that rotating bezel is really, really nice. So Samsung got it right with this one, and it's kind of let it ride for 2 years. And this, even though it'll call it the Galaxy Watch 3, it is the second generation Galaxy Watch. So I'm excited about this. I think it'll be a really good product.
Yeah, I think it's going to be great. And you're 100% right. I completely glossed over that. When people actually go to use it, that rotating bezel is slick.
Yeah, it works really well. Okay, so we're going to take another quick break to thank another sponsor and two sponsors today because people like us, okay? And we'll be right back and we'll finish off with some OnePlus Nord and a brand new segment. So stay with us. This episode of the Android Central podcast is brought to you by SanDisk. So we've been talking about this for the last few weeks. SanDisk's Ultra Dual Drive Lux USB Type-C flash drive is amazing. It has a Type-C USB port on one side, and it has a USB-A port on the other side. You can plug it into your phone. You can then plug it into another phone, or you can plug it into a laptop, a desktop, or anything that accepts a USB-A drive. and it's pretty great. You can store files, photos, documents, whatever you want on it, and it saves you having to upload your files to the cloud. It's a lot safer and more secure, and it comes with SanDisk's Memory Zone app that makes transferring it from your Android phone easy and safe and fast and amazing. You go all the way from 32 gigs to 1 terabyte of storage with up to 150 megabytes per second in read speeds to save time transferring those high-res images and 4K UHD videos. We've been using it with our Android phones for a long time to transfer big files at conferences as well as smaller documents that we don't want on the cloud. And right now, you can get your Ultra Dual Drive Lux USB Type-C flash drive from SanDisk for 10% off your first order by going to sandisk.com/ACP. That's S for Sam, A, N for Nancy, D, I, S for Sam, K. I'm reading a telephone number here. sandisk.com/ACP. For more information and to get 10% off your first order. And thanks, SanDisk, for sponsoring the Android Central podcast. All right, let's round out the show, guys, with some new OnePlus Nord. Jesus, what a name.
I have seen this. We need to start there, right? Because I've seen this all over Twitter for the last week. I am so much happier with Nord than I am a random string of numbers and letters.
It just doesn't bother me at all.
Like it's still weird to say out loud, and I loved, we'll get into this in a second. I loved the CEO's explanation for why Nord was chosen, but I can't be mad at it because it's so much better than just letters and numbers.
It just lets me line up so many Skyrim jokes that I'm going to be happy for years.
So, okay, Russell referred to this CEO tweet. So this is Carl Pei, who's OnePlus's chief marketing officer, but what it seems like is that, you know, there's some internal, you know, inside baseball stuff here that we won't necessarily get into, but Carl is a more public presence for OnePlus in the West than he is in India and China, because Carl speaks fluent English and Pete Lau, the CEO, does not. And he's been using a translator for a long time. Pete was reticent to be in the public eye because he wasn't able to speak English. And recently he's sort of overcome that. He's learned some, basic English, conversational English, and he's been able to do interviews without the use of a translator. But he's become a much more public focus of OnePlus over the last few years, as most CEOs would want to do. Carl, meanwhile, has sort of started his own little division within OnePlus, where the Nord is not just a single product, but it'll be a line of cheaper, more mainstream phones as OnePlus moves its higher, you know, its numbered series, I guess, to be focused on the mainstream flagship market, and especially with carriers in the US. So that's sort of the backstory behind the Nord brand. And then here's what he said about the name. Some people have been asking what the Nord name means. It comes from the concept of true north. We each have this inner compass that guides us. This product line reminds us to always search for our true north, and we hope it will keep reminding you of yours.
It's a phone, dude. Like,
I love it. It's beautiful. It's really poetic. It's lovely, but it's just about a phone. So, Russell, man, like,
amazing.
I don't even know where to go with
it. But it's not, you know, every time I see people complain about it, I look down at my Sony WX1000R2s.
Yeah.
And I'm like, no, this is better. This is fine.
You're right. Yeah, exactly. iPhone 11 Pro Max.
Yeah.
I just want to see the OnePlus Khajiit and the OnePlus Dunmer. I'll stop.
I would prefer a dragon. As long as we get a Dragonborn edition in India, then we're fine.
What was that Gundam edition? It was the Reno 3
Pro. I don't get to complain about this as often as I would like, because I'm not on this podcast often, but And the India has gotten some really awesome visual versions of phones over the last 2 years. And it kind of makes me sad that they don't get released elsewhere, because I would buy all of them and not have any money anymore.
You hear that? Make them. Russell will buy them all.
That's right.
Yeah, I bet you a GearBest third-party seller would love to sell you a Gundam.
Oh, I'm sure. Yeah.
Edition Reno 3.
Well, because they did that Iron Man version of the Samsung phone a couple years back. And
yeah,
then OnePlus,
the Galaxy S9?
OnePlus had, didn't OnePlus have a Black Panther version?
Yes.
That came, that no, also looked really slick. Like, yeah, it's...
Yep.
No, there was a Star Wars version.
There was a Star Wars version. I thought there was a Black Panther version, too. Maybe I made that up.
Somebody built a Black Panther phone.
Yeah.
Because I wanted it. It looked so cool.
The Star Wars version was sick, too.
We can just pretend it happened. It's fine. So, here's the phone. We know that it's going to be under 500 euros. It's not going to be available in North America, so don't get your hopes up. But it's going to run a Snapdragon 765G. It will basically have flagship level camera. That's what Carl Pei is saying, whatever that means. But under 500 euros is not that 299 price that had been teased for a long time. I don't think anybody realistically thought this phone would be priced at the same price as the OnePlus One back in 2014. So many things have changed in the market since then. But 500 euros does not seem like a bad price for a phone this powerful, especially if it's 5G enabled.
No, I look at this phone and I wish it would be like every other phone and straight convert euros to dollars and I could buy it for 500 bucks because I would use that phone until it stopped working. I don't understand the reasoning for not selling it in North America.
There's a reason. It's because very few people buy $500 phones in North America. They have the data to prove it. And with financing plans being the way majority of people buy their phones, it's easy to justify a $900 OnePlus 8 over a $500 phone that you would probably buy outright.
I guess. I'd buy them all. I'd be Russell. Just send them here. I'll buy all of them.
You just hang them on your wall when you're done with them. It's
yeah. So David Ruddick was on the All About Android podcast last week, and he had a really good explanation for this. And he basically said OnePlus is not making any money from this phone. Its margins are so thin, even at 500 euro, that it's not worth bringing it to North America, where the carriers like to take a cut. And nobody buys unlocked phones, or like relatively nobody buys unlocked phones. So that's kind of it. One thing I like about this phone, in addition to the fact that it's going to be relatively small, is it has a wide angle front facing camera, which is amazing. I've been using it. I ranted about this, I think, 2 weeks ago, or was it last? I can't remember. Time doesn't have meaning anymore. But I ranted about the fact that I've been using the Pixel 3 XL, which has a wide-angle front-facing camera. It's amazing, and everybody should have a wide-angle front-facing camera on their phone. So this will have that. Other than that, I don't know. This kind of, it just looks like a huge marketing machine that will otherwise not be that impressive, or it'll be less important in the long run than I think we are giving it credence for right now.
I think what impresses most people is the phone you're getting for the price you're getting. And that's only because every other good phone is now $1,000.
Yeah.
And this looks like it's going to be a good phone for half the price.
Yeah. In certain markets, in India specifically.
Right. And that's impressive if OnePlus can pull that off. And they're probably not making any money now. 6 months from now, they would make money selling it for 500 euros. But 6 months from now, it'll be 350 euros, and they still won't be making any money. So I get it. I just still want one.
It's funny. If phones lasted like 6-7 years the way that consoles do, they could just come out with a mid-cycle refresh, cut the size of the internals in half and make a ton of money off them. It would be super easy.
Some phones do last 6 years. Don't you have a iPhone 6S there?
I was waiting until you said that. That's why I brought it up.
That pisses me off. I mean,
yes,
Google,
it did.
You need to fix
it. Pissed
that.
off It pissed off a lot of other people too, because when you wrote about it on AndroidCentral.com, we had more traffic to that article than any other post this entire year. Thanks, our Android. We still don't like you. Okay, let's end this with a new segment that I'm stealing directly from one of my favorite podcasts, Pop Culture Happy Hour. It's called What's Making Us Happy This Week. The reason I'm bringing this into the show at the end is that we talk a lot about tech, and we are all very interesting and interested people that do a whole bunch of other things, that like and watch a whole bunch of other things and just have interests outside of tech. And I want to get a conversation going about what some of those things are. So we'll go around. It's a round table, and everybody will just say what they have enjoyed this week. And we'll start with you, Russell. What is making you happy this week?
Oh, so just earlier today, actually, my girlfriend and I finished watching this last season of What We Do in the Shadows. And every episode of this season so far has just brought me such joy. But the last two episodes in particular, as we do just a whole bunch more stuff with the character Guillermo, I can't stop laughing. This show is so well done. And I just, if you're not watching it, you really should just take some time, because it will just bring so much joy into your life.
Where is it available?
It's on FX, I think. And you can, I've been watching it through it YouTube TV, but it's Tatiana, I almost said Tatiana Maslany. That's Orphan Black. Taika Waititi is the producer. Him and his partner in crime, Jermaine, put the show together. It was originally a movie. And it is what happens if you follow vampires in the same way that you do things in The Office. So like the show The Office, but vampires, but also vampires that are not very good at being vampires. And it's just so funny.
Oh my God, that sounds amazing.
Yes, that does. That's something that I'll be watching. Thank you.
And Jerry, what's making you happy this week?
My best friend in the whole wide world is a bird. And feeding, I love my parents.
I love this, like, Jerry.
Well, you guys know me and you know that's true. But parrots are very expensive to feed. So I got looking and, you know, ways how you can make homemade food for your parrot. And there's a website called Bird Tricks Store. It's a very nice group of people who help you train your parrot. They sell a book series called The Natural Feeding System. And it's, you buy healthy fruits and vegetables and you cook meals that you and your bird can both eat. And I have been trying it. And my bird is extremely happy. He gets to make a mess with fettuccine and pancakes. And I get to sit and eat with him and give him a bite of my food. And it has just made me so happy the past few days. I've just started doing it. And I know it's something that I'm going to continue. And I have already saved more money by not buying a big bag of bird pellets from Amazon that makes up for the purchase of the book.
I love this so much. I need a video of your bird eating pancakes. I need to see what happens when a bird destroys a bird-friendly pancake.
It's just like you imagine. There are pancakes everywhere.
That's so great.
Oh my God. Please film the next time you do it and put it online.
I will try. No promises, because he does not like cameras. I have a... several cameras that I need to fix, because bird beaks are very strong.
Oh wow. Yeah, that's crazy. What about you, Daniel?
Well, you can do it surreptitiously, but we can't wait to see that. So what's people may know, given how hyper I am sometimes on the show, I love coffee, and I just introduced myself to cold brew at home. I love cold brew coffee, but I just haven't ventured into making it at home. I kind of was intimidated by it. I don't know why, because I discovered that it's basically just steeping coffee for 24 hours in sort of in a carafe. Super easy. So last week I bought myself a Hario Mitsudashi cold brew maker. It's like $25 on Amazon. You grind coffee. You pour cold filtered water in it. You sit it on your counter for 20 to 24 hours, and then you chill it in the fridge, and or you just put straight on ice, and it is incredible. It is so delicious. There's no bitterness that comes with trying to like drink cold coffee, or just like, you know, whatever, badly making cold brew coffee some other way. Highly recommend it. If you have any questions, I'm at Journey Dan. because I will talk to you about coffee all day. This is like my favorite thing. This is me eating fettuccine with my parrot.
That's awesome. So like if you're making a batch, how much does the machine make for you? Is it like, is it a whole day's, like the next whole day's worth of servings for you, or is it?
Oh yeah.
Okay.
Well, for yeah. Daniel,
you make a liter. So
okay. Attached to a 55 gallon drum.
Yeah. So you use, so when I make coffee in the morning, like hot coffee, I usually use like 35 to 50 grams of coffee, depending on how much I'm making. And that'll give me a cup and a half, say 2 cups. This makes you use 110 grams. You use double to triple the amount, but it makes a liter of coffee, which is
way more economical.
Two or three days.
So that's awesome.
It's enough. And if I plan my brewing right, I won't ever run out. But yeah, it's highly recommend it. It is it's really, especially now that it's hot as hell outside in a lot of the US. Yeah, it's great.
That's very cool.
I've never had cold coffee other than my coffee got cold. And
right, exactly.
You know that tastes horrible. But cold coffee doesn't taste that way if it's cold brewed?
No, it doesn't, because the cold, what you're doing is you're drinking coffee that has been oxidizing in like in an ambient temperature that is not ideal for a long time, and then you're like, oh, this tastes super bitter.
I picture Daniel in a lab coat with a thermometer and as Dr. Coffee.
You would not be far from the truth, actually. I take this very seriously.
Huh, that's fascinating. I really want to try cold coffee.
It's super easy, honestly. It's really, I'll send you the link, because I will do that. All right, that's it. I'm so happy we're doing this, because I want to hear everybody's favorite things every week. Russell, Jerry, thank you so much. We'll give a link to your socials. Russell, you are at Russell Holly, and Jerry, you are at GB Hill. I'm at Journey Dan. We're all at Android Central. You can find us everywhere else. And I'm sorry, I'm just thinking about coffee now. We will be back next week with a brand new show. And if you have any feedback, send it to podcast@Android Central. We love hearing from you. How do you brew your coffee? Let me know. That's it. We will talk to you later. Bye-bye.
Later.
Adios.